Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. For our international listeners, the podcast will be held mostly in English. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality. Happy New Year. This is episode 84 of the Voices on Art podcast. It is the first podcast of 2024, and in a way also the last podcast of 2023, as it was recorded November 29, 2023. My guest, Tobias Zeloni, is a German artist, photographer, filmmaker, and professor at Hochschule für Bildende Kunst in Hamburg. He's also participating in the exhibition No Promises, No Demands at Van Horn Düsseldorf. And I'm so much looking forward to this talk because what Tobias does is so manifold. There are so many directions, so many things. So I really don't know where to start. And this is why first I say hi, Tobias.
Hello. Hi.
And then we start as always from the beginning, which is a little bit your background, your biography, where do you come from, and also how did photography slash art enter into your life?
Okay, great. So you
just start.
Okay. Yeah, it's always the question where to start or where is the beginning, right?
Yes, where's the beginning?
Yeah, in my case, yeah, my family had really not much to do with art, even with universities or something like that. But my father and then my brother, who's a lot older, they were like kind of keen amateur photographers, and they had cameras. And at some point I inherited my brother's camera. I mean, we're talking, I think I was 16 or maybe even younger, 15 probably. So that's how I kind of started taking photos.
What were your first photos?
Oh, I don't really remember, but I mean, I did probably a lot of like cheesy train tracks and black and white industrial structures and stuff, but yeah, but also some portraits already. Mm-hmm. I remember. Oh, actually, yes, the story is that I was a bit like I was painting as a teenager. It was oil colors, and then at some point I used photograph for the paintings, and I even then saw it was a little bit strange. And then I liked the photography more. I mean, it was a lot easier, so to say.
That's true.
Yeah, so I think I wanted to become a photographer somehow when I was a teenager, but I really didn't have any idea what it even mean mm-hmm. to be a commercial photographer or a fashion photographer or an artist working with photography. I mean,
a teenager was like in the 80s, 90s, early 90s.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So photography already had kind of lost a little bit of its coolness because in the 60s, 70s, it was still like really hot to be a photographer and you could make a lot of money, and that changed very, very fast.
Yeah, I don't think I was interested in money at all.
Make a living, probably better to say.
Make a living. Yeah, I mean, I really never met anybody who was making a living from it.
Mm.
But then I made an internship in a commercial studio that was really not my cup of tea. But then I worked for 2 years in a kind of commercial studio. We photographed a lot in factories and products, but also made a lot of portraits. It was kind of really good. I learned a lot, and we worked analog, sometimes with a large format camera, medium format. So I actually learned a lot, but I also learned that I don't want to have anything to do with commercial
completely
life.
Understand.
Yeah. So and then I applied for different art schools in Düsseldorf, for example. And
really? In the Becher class?
I guess it was still Becher then.
It was still Becher then, yes.
Yeah, but they didn't want me, basically.
Oh, lucky and you.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. My life would have gone a different turn.
Absolutely.
So in the end, I was accepted in Berlin in a smaller school, and that was more like design based. And after a year and a half, I decided I don't want to be a designer either. And then I basically made the right move going to Newport in Wales, where I started to study documentary photography in a really famous school at the time. I wanted to go like for maybe 1 year, and I stayed for 3 years, and I really learned a lot there. That's not where my artist career started, but that's where I really found a place where I felt like this is what I want to do.
I was wondering, when I read this, that you studied in Wales, what is the difference, the approach towards photography in England versus Germany, for example? Did you notice a difference?
I mean, first of all, Wales is not England.
Oh, sorry. Apologies.
Yeah, but let's say in the UK.
In the UK.
I think at the time, in Germany at the time, everything like documentary or even social, politically stuff wasn't really on.
Mm.
But in the UK, there were people like Paul Graham and maybe even Martin Parr.
Mm.
Before there was Chris Killip. A lot of people who worked with photography in a political way, but also showing in museums and galleries and making rather large prints.
Mm.
And still dealing with the kind of political reality. I mean, that was more in the mid-90s, but it was still like the kind of aftermath of the neoliberal turn in the UK and the criticism of it. So I felt a lot more at home in that context. You know, and I mean, Newport is this kind of super working class city with a steel factory and a harbor that is no longer working. And the school was still trying to document that. And I think in Germany, something like that wasn't happening.
Mm.
In the 1990s. I mean, it was the height of the Becher School.
Yes.
And the rest was kind of, not really clear outside of Düsseldorf where the direction would go.
Yeah, that's true. You couldn't escape that kind of photography in the 90s in Germany. Yeah. Then in Wales, you finished your degree. Was that the first project that kind of like led to what you're doing now, that you're photographing the youth in Bristol?
I did it already, I think in the first year, second year, third year. I kind of found my way there. I think already in the first year, I decided I was going to this kind of council estate in the valleys, in this former mining area, mm-hmm. north of Newport, where the mines had closed. And I want to make a portrait, if you want to say so, of the whole place, of the estate. But I decided to focus on this group of young people that was hanging out on the streets. So already in my first year there, it wasn't a decision really, but I found it easier. And I thought it's also the group I could easily relate to.
Because it was your generation?
A little bit, yeah.
At that time?
At the time, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, especially that first project, they were more like my generation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, then over the years, of course, I grew older, but I could totally relate to them. Yeah, I would say my generation. Yeah.
I'm just making a big jump now, but this is just a question that arises and probably that you were asked very often, because as you said, you're growing older, but your subject's not. And I was thinking about this. Is that because youth is more visible in public space?
With recent projects, I kind of try to get a little bit beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, but not always, protagonists are still young people. But I think it's the question really is, has it always been about youth or even coming of age? And I would say no. I think mm-hmm. it's more about certain like environments, both like, let's say, in terms of the urban space, but also economically and politically, in which the people I photograph are kind of the protagonists, you know, for the narratives that they make of their own life and I kind of create, or we do create together. And obviously, I mean, at the time, especially before social media, when you were young, you wanted to be outside, to be in touch with other people.
Absolutely, yes.
That was the kind of, there were not many other places for that, especially in those kind of places like Newport or Halle Neustadt or something. So they were maybe the last people to use the public space as really a place of public exchange. I mean, of course, it's not like disappeared from the world, but at least in those kind of, let's say, European, let's say, yeah, post-working class areas.
And especially at night, I mean, it's like you would just meet in the evening, you would hang out with each other, sometimes until late in the morning, when you were young.
Yeah, I mean, that's also something you do when you're young, basically. And And yeah, I mean, that's the other big thing that I'm interested in, that is night and darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And both, of course, aesthetically, but also with all levels of meaning. And you mentioned my degree project, it's called Curfew. I did in Bristol and Newport about kind of project by police to put individual people, like young people, under a night curfew. They said, "Oh, you've done so much trouble, but you're too young to go to prison, so we put you under curfew." And it was kind of a pilot project, like a test. And it was also heavily criticized because it wasn't clear if it's in any way legal to do that. So that meant that the night became kind of political, and being outside was a bit of a challenge for the people. So it wasn't just like hanging out, you know. So, and when you look at the history of night and urban space and the history of street lighting, it's very much a history of police trying to gain control over darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a book about mostly the history of street lighting in Paris, that it was starting with kind of, I don't know how you call it, like open fire, these kind of lanterns, and then gas lanterns and electric lanterns. And it was very often the police who was pushing forward with those things in order to control the city at night.
Well, as a woman, I have a little bit of a different approach towards that, because you feel double unsafe in dark space at night.
I totally agree. It is important to have light at night and create like a safer environment.
Well, it's a kind of twilight. Even, you know, even if you light spaces outside of the, let's say, lighting zone, it's still dark. And this is what I find also very intriguing in your photographs, because you can see that. You can see kind of like this double light, the transition of light to darkness. And it's very special, I think, because as you in other interviews, you said now also that photography, actually the classical photography, it means a drawing with light.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing to say about photography, but mm-hmm. you really need light for photography. I mean, even digital photography, you need some kind of light in the real world. I mean, if you talk about AI or something, it's different. But if you're kind of taking an image of something in front of the camera, put it that way, you need a light source, at least any light source.
True.
And yeah, photography cannot live without light, basically.
But still, you chose to photograph mostly during the night. And you also went from studying documentary photography very fast into something which still shows some documentation, but is much more art. How did that happen to you? Or what was the decision behind that?
I mean, I found so many interesting aspects about the work, what I was doing there for myself, at least. It wasn't interesting to other people at the time, maybe, but there were so many things. One thing what I was interested in was fashion, like the tracksuits people were wearing there. Then the idea that a space is kind of created by people.
Mm-hmm.
And something I already noticed, and even in Newport, was that the way that my pictures looked and the way people were like performing for the camera was going beyond what is like the classical documentary idea. It was more like a kind of staging or creating a kind of set, in a sense, maybe. Also, the darkness helps a lot, I guess, because it maybe looks a little bit similar to a theater or a film set. I mean, the darkness in combination with any kind of lighting.
Sure.
So the classical narrative of the documentary wasn't so important to me. You know, I tried once to go to a picture editor of a newspaper, and he was like, "Yeah, but what is it about? I don't see a story in it," you know. And then I turned it around, thinking that there is no real like story. Is maybe the story, you know, like the mines and the factories have long closed, and all these stories have been told again and again, but the people are still there, but they somehow don't fall into the way the public would describe reality.
Mm.
I guess with that kind of thinking, and also with the kind of photography I did, I kind of intuitively understood I'm not going to be a documentary photographer in a classical sense. I mean, at the time we were still trained to be like a newspaper or magazine photographer, even though that kind of, let's call it market,
that was already dead.
It was maybe not dead, but it was in total decline. We talk late 90s. So I didn't see any perspectives there, really. And also we had a teacher, Paul Sievert, in Newport, who really encouraged us to think outside the box and think about exhibition space. So it was kind of a natural move to me to go to Leipzig, to Tim Rautert, and keep studying there at a kind of proper art academy.
Mm-hmm. I find it very puzzling that this newspaper guy told you where's the story, because I think there is a story in the series you're doing. I think there is a storytelling. It's just not the simple way. It's not the direct way. And it's a story that can also be told differently in different spaces and in different combination of images, you know, because you combine the landscape, the cityscape, and the portraits, it kind of becomes an extended portrait story about the people that dwell in those places. I don't know if that's formulated right, but probably you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I guess what happened in the 90s was what was called then the end of meta-narratives, that traditionally those kind of stories, or however you would call them, were kind of operating in a bigger framework, like these big narratives to explain the world, may it be Marxism or whatever, religion. And those kind of meta-narratives help to kind of put things into place, to help understand or read things in a way they were supposed to read. But if you don't have that framework, also the narratives become kind of unclear or like ambiguous.
But right now they're coming back big scale, don't you think?
The meta-narratives, yeah, I mean, they are, in a sense, yes. I mean, the other big meta-narrative that's totally gone was the idea of the camera telling the truth objectivity or anything like that. I mean, I never believed in that. But that was still kind of what some photographers relied on, and saying, I want to show how the world is. I never relied on that. And I think that was another major blow to documentary photography.
Yeah, absolutely. But did your approach through the years, because you traveled the world, I mean, you went to so many different countries and found your protagonists there, and for a while being part of that scene, did your approach change over the years just through you becoming older?
I would say that I work in a very different way, and I've introduced a lot of other things into the work. I mean, most prominent moving image and text that I write or that other people write, or interviews, and with the recent works also kind of fictional text or like even kind of science fiction. So I think the approach has changed, but I'm still kind of with most projects. I mean, there are some exceptions, like the work from Malta, where I filmed tanker ships with through a telescope. You can hardly see people. And if you can see them, you can hardly recognize them. But normally it's still that in the center of my work, there are human beings, put it that way. They don't have to be young, and the works like move around them. And of course, the approach how to, let's say, get in touch with people is also very different. At the time in Newport or in Bristol or in Halle, Marseille, I would basically go out in the evening and try to talk to people and photograph them if they would let me.
Yeah.
Because also in some places, people didn't even have cell phones. So there was no other way of exchange and communication. And now it's a lot more like the recent project in Moldova, where I went a lot through like Instagram and making contact with people. But still, I was going to a bar and I met my main protagonist there. But the difference is maybe that I met him and I said, look, I've seen you already with your friends earlier today, and I was wondering if I could photograph you, and here's my Instagram. And he looked at it and he was like, yes, let's go outside. I call my friends. So it was a totally different setup. I mean, it was almost like he had been waiting to be maybe discovered or something. But he totally understood what I was doing, because he could see my images. He could read the language. He could tell that I'm like in former times, people thought maybe I'm a police officer or whoever. And it was clear, like in 10 seconds, what I'm doing, what kind of photography I'm looking for.
So are people more trustful now? Are they more open to these kinds of projects?
I would say yes. But in many, many times, they're also less interested because photography is not so exciting anymore, or having a picture taken.
Yeah.
Also my kind of, let's say, style, it is appealing, but it's one next to 100 other styles that are out there that people consume every day. So I think it's very different. I think it's also nice because people have a lot more understanding and control of what it means to make an image and create an image together. But the situation has shifted for sure. But people trust me more because they can just Google me. Yeah.
Yes, they can get all the information they need about you. I think nobody really realizes how different that is.
I mean, before, I liked that too. It was really about me and kind of developing some kind of trust and spending time together, which was also probably one of the reasons why I do it, because I like that kind of getting to know people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really just enjoy that besides taking photos. Yeah, things are going on a lot faster these days. 20 years ago, I would make a print in the dark room and would go back and give the print to the people. And now I can send them through Instagram or WhatsApp or whatever, Telegram, an image overnight and they post it. So the whole kind of circulation of images is a lot faster.
But in the end, in the exhibitions, there are still framed works or videos. For that, you still have to go through the whole production process. And I think also that people, the reception of the work in an exhibition space is much different than the reception of the work on Instagram.
Oh, of course it is. But that's the funny thing about photography, that it has so many lives. I mean, mostly in Newport, we were working to put the prints in a box to do something with them later, like go to a newspaper or whatever. So they were like a possibility for something, but they weren't the final thing. And I still think this is true about photography today, that the same image can appear in a lot of different contexts and have different meanings. I mean, a lot of artists try to kind of have as much control over that, but I'm also interested in what happens to my photos, what other people, you know, do with them in a sense, what kind of lives they have. So I think that's something that is interesting to me.
So you give up a little bit of the control?
A little bit.
Because you trust. I have the feeling a lot of what you're doing is about trust.
Yeah, I hope it is. It is.
Trusting in the others that it will be okay. And kind of like building trust with the people that they can be on your images and feel good about it, or be in this video you showed at Marta, where the kids are looking at, the young people are looking at the TV and discussing it.
Yeah, I mean, they're all like older than 18. They're in their 20s, I would say.
They're still young.
Still young, yeah, but they're not like kids maybe. Yeah, I mean, that was a very special moment watching television together with people, because it's a very intimate moment that even if we don't do that anymore, I don't have a TV. But we all have these memories of sitting in a TV together, maybe with our parents or with friends.
Yeah, sitting together, that's a different thing than each one looking at their smartphone.
Oh, yeah, it is. But it was also, some people said, oh, we haven't done that in a long time.
Yes.
But but still, the TV is a kind of echo chamber or mirror in the room. It's, you know, it's still not looking at each other so much, because you look together at a TV and then we start talking about what you see. I filmed it in different rooms, it's different TVs and different people. It has an equally like dark environment, mostly only illuminated by the TV. I was first interested in the fact that in Estonia, in Narva, where I made the work, the fact that the Estonian government had switched off all Russian news channels and propaganda channels at the beginning of the full-scale invasion in Ukraine. So there are these kind of dead channels on TV that are not operable anymore. And that was where the idea came from. And then I thought, okay, let's watch together with the people and talk about what they see or what they don't see. I mean, I think there are some, I don't know if it was Paul Graham, I think so. There were people, Valley Export, I discovered later there were works dealing with people in front of a television, like showing them. But the main idea was coming from like how to work about that fact that these channels had been switched off.
Just to be able to identify the meta-narrative, which can be propaganda, just talking about it is in a way a political act. To me, it sounds like that you do a very proper research about the situation in the countries where you go to?
I think I do, but it's a lot of research is done when I'm there. I'm trying to talk to as many people as possible. And not only the people I end up photographing or interviewing, just anybody. So in Narva, the story came from a volunteer, a woman who helped Ukrainian refugees once they crossed from Russia to Narva. There's a border station there. I was interviewing her about the refugee situation in Narva and the work they did as activists. And she told me that story that at the time she was working at a night porter in a hotel right at the border. And then people traveling through, like Russian people were, or Russian-speaking Estonians were complaining that they couldn't find any Russian channel anymore. So it came out of this kind of interview I made that I didn't use in the end for the project. So it's kind of research, but yeah, it's basically talking to many people. And now I was in Rochester, New York State, the home of Kodak. And I went to libraries, I talked to professors of the university, I met with artists, you know. So it's kind of a really broad research in a sense, but I noticed that a lot of it cannot be done from home for some reason. I mean, it could be maybe, but I'm not the kind of person to do that.
So you need, I mean, place just plays a very different role for you. Being at a place and feeling the place and meeting the people in reality. And do you record these interviews or do you just make notes or how is that?
I mean, in that case, I recorded it actually. Mm-hmm. But most of the time I don't. I just talk to people and I don't even make notes. It's more like, I mean, I make notes, of course, but I don't sit there and make notes. It's more like, gathering ideas and stories and information that kind of form something, you know. But the good thing is I'm not a journalist, so...
No, you're an artist. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, maybe not whatever I want, but I have a lot more freedom in my thinking and can also put, like, different things together that seem unconnected or something.
You have the responsibility for your protagonists, that's true. But as an artist, you can put the images in your own artistic context and you can tell your own artistic story.
I can, but of course there are limits. So I don't want to like lie or put people, you know, I think most important is what you said. It's like, I want that people are actually happy with what I do, the people I film or photograph. And maybe it's not exactly what they expected or what they would do themselves. So it's not like I'm trying to please them as good as I can, but I want them to somehow like it or accept it. And that, of course, is a challenge sometimes because I have my own like artistic ideas. But I think it worked, I mean, over the last project, so that people, when they, like, I tag them on Instagram and I see they repost it, they repost an like installation shot, or they write me and say, oh, I'm so happy. You know, so I think it's a limitation that I put on myself. But I think it's also important, you know, it's a kind of responsibility.
Yeah, people feel seen, obviously. What I find really interesting is you just have the cast in the exhibition right now at the gallery. And I have so many students, I mean, professors with their students, groups of students coming in, looking at that, which is especially your work. And so mostly photography students, but not only. So they are in their 20s usually, and they are very strongly reacting because the cast is an earlier work from 2007. So I assume it was still done with analog film.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
They react very strong on that, on the difference between analog and digital. Is that a real difference for you also when you work now? Did that change something in your approach?
Not so much,
really. Not so much.
It changed a lot of practicalities. I mean, I can, in Los Angeles, where I photographed the cast, I was using a tripod, I think, still a lot, even for some of the pictures that are in the gallery now. And obviously you had to kind of, when you photograph at night, you always had to deal with darkness, problem of exposure. But also this thing that I mentioned before, I always want to give people prints, or nowadays send them JPEGs.
Yes, sure.
But how to have them processed and make prints in LA at the time, and then how to find people again, give the people the prints. Also for myself, understanding what I'm doing. Like, I made a project at the same time in Trona in the Californian desert.
Mm-hmm.
It's a daytime project, my only, well, maybe not the only, but one of my daytime projects. But I shot a lot of photos. I went there 5 times and then I had the contact sheets. And when I came back from the US after a year, I mean, I was in the US a year, but I thought it doesn't work. It doesn't come together, you know? So because I was just trying things and taking photos, and only later I realized what I had done there, but that was maybe a year or two later. And nowadays, normally when I photograph, I come home and look at the photos and I make a selection, and I already try to think about which pictures could work together or what direction to go. So also I can work a lot faster with the images. Aesthetically, I probably like the analog prints more.
Mm.
Maybe it's also nostalgia, I don't know.
No, I don't think so, because that was a really young person who said today they also like it better for some reason. And I usually also like it better. I don't really know why that is. If that is just an illusion or just an, I don't know, something more immaterial, some physicality, I really don't know. But they have something which sometimes it's lacking in digital imagery. I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I was lucky that people didn't even notice when I moved from analog to digital. So I think the difference is not so big. I mean, I have some other theories also. You can also really try hard and have the look of the analog.
Yo, but that's fake.
Yeah, I'm not going that route.
Yeah.
But still, I think my pictures have a very similar aesthetics, both analog and digital.
And atmosphere, yeah. Because I think probably with your imagery, the whole approach around it is so important. I mean, it's also the way how you get the final image. It's not just about the masterpiece that comes out in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in masterpieces, but you have to also understand that the way of taking photos is very different. So it's, in many ways, it's slower. It's kind of more invisible, because neither me nor the people I photograph see the result, the direct result.
Yeah.
And then I also think that the way people are in front of the camera has changed dramatically over the last 15 years. And that might be the biggest reason the biggest thing that the students may read in the photos. Because now everyone, not only young people, is very used to be photographed or photograph themselves. And there is like a lot more, I would say this kind of feedback loop is a lot more established and faster. So there is a different kind of curiosity about the moment of photography in my work. But if you go further back in time, it's a lot more. If you look at August Sanda, or there's a certain kind of, people know what to do, or they think they know what to do, you know, in front of the camera.
Is there more posing then?
Of course. I mean, there was posing before. The question is, what kind of posing?
Yes.
And what is it relating to? When I started, I thought the posing is somewhere coming from the kind of subconscious, like this kind of collective subconsciousness of imagery, like from film, for example, or music videos, stuff like that. And now it's probably a lot of social media photos and selfies. I mean, this kind of feedback loop we can do with ourselves, you know.
I mean, this constantly being in circle with yourself, just by contacting the people, you open that up. So it's always kind of like a mutual effort.
Yes, of course it is. I think it's always been like that.
As we said, you were hoping also that it's a lot about trust. The way you look at people, I assume it affected you also privately, or is there no difference? As with a lot of artists, the way you look at the world, is there a private Tobias Zeloni? Or is it always, it's the artist?
Oh, it's for sure there is a private Tobias Stiloni. I mean, when I was younger, I would run around the world and always think, how would that look like in a photo?
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, if I go on holiday, I don't even bring a camera, or at least not a real camera.
Yeah, but you have your iPhone.
Yeah, I have my iPhone. And I would think it's less like this kind of technical or aesthetical relationship to the world, but more like in terms of experience of having met or meeting a lot of different people in your life and going to places. So I think that, of course, plays an important role in one's life. It's different from being a painter in a studio and they just stay there.
Mm.
It's a different lifestyle, I guess, as an artist.
It's also about communication more.
Of course, yeah. But it's not limited to photographers or something. You know, it could be anyone.
Anyone going out meeting other people.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, photography is a weird thing. And from the beginning, I think I had a hard time identifying with the role of the photographer. It makes me a lot happier to think of me as an artist. And so, yeah, I don't know. I try to think about my relationship to the world beyond photography and also to people. I think it would be sad if it would be defined by that. And I always feel a bit sorry for people who run around day and night with a camera. Maybe if they're students, maybe it's good. So then they take a lot of photos, but yeah.
Yeah, the ambivalence of the photographer. I completely get that because it's in a way, now photography is everywhere. This is why, for example, I stopped because everything I learned was suddenly so passé, you know, with the big format cameras and all of that techniques. And on the other hand, it's such a relevant medium we're confronted with all the time.
Yeah, but I really hope that that is coming across with my works. I think from the beginning, but more and more so over the last maybe 10 years, that my work is not only about what it is about, like the people and the place, but also about media itself, the relationship of images. It could also be moving images or animated images in the world or as the world or with the world. So I think that's really like half of my practice, because sometimes the stories are so interesting and the places, people forget about that and they keep asking me about this and that persons. I always wonder what role, let's say, like technical images, it's really hard to define what photographs are nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's important because it shapes the way we see the world.
It does, but it was really interesting. I'm teaching in Hamburg, as you said, and last week our class invited Hito Steil to give a talk at the university, and she said something that there is like a major shift happening. I mean, she said that before, but from the old like photographic apparatus and practice that is still like thinking about here is the machine and there is the world, and somehow there is a kind of trace of light, of material. So it's kind of looking back at the world or at the world in a certain moment. But the new machines, she was mostly talking about machines that generate images in terms of CGI or artificial intelligence, they are kind of producing images, they're kind of projections into the future. But they have a really weird relationship to, let's say, the outside world. And then, of course, the question is, is it still a photograph if you have a computer-generated image? So.
And the question is also, where do we find ourselves there?
Of course. I mean, but I guess that's happening with any new media. So that we are relating to it. But obviously, media or images in whatever way are just gaining an importance, put it that way. The role they play in our life, or they kind of take over our lives or replace our real life, I think is stronger than ever. So it's important to work about it or to think about it.
Absolutely. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, so I went to Rochester to do research, and I mostly did research.
And Kodak, it's about the history of Kodak?
I mean, I don't want to say yet, because I discovered something interesting in the history of Kodak.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I went there is that I'm invited to do a project again for the Festival Osten in Wolfenbitterfeld, where I did a project last year about an archival film that stores digital data that they produce there, the only stuff that was still produced at the time last year, that is supposed to last 1,000 years, like a time capsule. And I wrote a text to go with it for the, let's say, people or alien or machines or whoever who might find this film in the future.
Yeah, there's the Catalog Wolfen.
There's a Catalog Wolfen, right, yeah, with Spectre Books that came out of the project. So the project became a lot bigger than planned. And now they make a connection for the next festival to two cities. And one is Rochester in New York State because of Kodak. I mean, I have to say Agfa, and then Orvo was involved. And so the big film factory in East Germany. And the other city connected is Shostka in Ukraine, where the Svema film factory was. So the kind of story goes, but I found out that it might not be the whole truth, is that at 1945, a lot of the knowledge about color film was transferred from Agfa to Kodak. It was a kind of narrative told in the GDR. And I think it's not the full picture at all. It might be some kind of propaganda even. Mm-hmm. So I did some research on that. But if what is true is that a lot of the machinery was taken by the Soviets from Wolfen to Shostka to use there in the film factory. At the same time in the like 45, 6 and so on. So that's what connects the three cities next to being the cities of major film factories. But what I might do in Wolfen is not really connected to that story anymore, not directly. But that was the kind of starting point for research of this kind of knowledge transfer.
So you're still in the research process and we will know more about it next year.
Next year, yeah. And I guess it will be, let's see, I don't know. It will probably be more conceptual work again, like Wolfen was also, yeah.
Do you ever think of your audience, how they look at the work?
I think yes. I think it would be foolish to say no. I mean, I guess some artists say that, but the question is how to think about it, how aware it enters your mind. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped that I think at the beginning of my career, people were like a little bit not sure about what I was doing. So I needed a lot of to be sure that I'm doing the right thing, this kind of feeling, you know, mm-hmm. not to rely on other people's opinions. So that really helps to gain some independence, but it's also a big trap once you have more success to think that, oh, I hope people are going to like it because they like that too or something. Mm-hmm. it's kind of difficult, but I think it's a negotiation within yourself and with other people. But I guess everything we do about images and art is this kind of negotiation anyway. But for sure, when I'm photographing, I'm not really thinking about that. I can tell that. But the process later, I think there's so many things that play into it. And for sure, the presentation in the end and even the visitors. I love visitors seeing the works. I mean, it's maybe not the only reason I do it. But if somebody looks at the work and say, oh, I don't know anything about art, but I really like it. Or I like that picture, that makes me happy, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
My feeling is that you have a certain kind of humbleness and openness, which is rare and I think a good thing needed. So, Tobias, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Please find links and a text about my guest in the show notes. For more information on Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast, follow us on Instagram at Voices on Art. And at van_horn_Düsseldorf, visit our website van-horn.net and subscribe to Voices on Art on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.